This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Elizabeth Marsh lived from 1735 to 1785. In her 50 years, she traveled over four continents. She led a remarkable life in remarkable times. Elizabeth Marsh and her family and the times in which they lived are the subject of the book The Ordeal of Elizabeth Marsh, A Woman in World History. The author is historian Linda Colley, and she is our guest in this portion of the program. Let me share with you an excerpt from the description of the book. This comes from the book's jacket. This is a book about a world in a life. Conceived in Jamaica and possibly of mixed race, Elizabeth Marsh traveled farther and was more intimately affected by developments across the globe than the vast majority of men. She was the first woman to publish in English on Morocco and the first to carry out extensive explorations in eastern and southern India. A creature of multiple frontiers, she spent time in London, Menorca, Rio de Janeiro, and the Cape of Africa. She speculated in Florida land, was caught up in the French and Indian War, was linked to voyages to the Pacific, and was enmeshed as victim or owner in three different systems of slavery. That comes from the description of Linda Colley's new book, The Ordeal of Elizabeth Marsh. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Linda Colley is an award-winning historian at Princeton University. Her previous books include Britain's Forging the Nation, 1701 to 1837, and Captives, Britain, Empire, and the World, 1600 to 1850. She's also a regular contributor to such publications as the New York Review of Books, The Nation, and The Guardian. Linda Colley's new book, The Ordeal of Elizabeth Marsh, is published by Pantheon. The New York Times has named it one of the best, one of the 10 best books of the year, one of the top five nonfiction books of 2007. And Professor Colley joins us this afternoon from Princeton. Good afternoon. It's so good to speak with you.
It's a great pleasure to be speaking to you and to so many other people.
Yes. Well, congratulations on the honor of being named one of the 10 best books of 2007 by the New York Times.
Thank you.
When I started reading this book and going page to page to page, I kept asking myself, what's next? When and where did you first come across Elizabeth Marsh, and were you intrigued from the start?
I was intrigued from the start, but it was a very serendipitous process. To begin with, all I knew about her was her capture in the Mediterranean in 1756, the fact that she's taken to Morocco, that she almost becomes a sexual slave in the court of Sidi Mohammed, this remarkable sultan of Morocco, in his court in Marrakesh. Heaven knows that was enough of a story, particularly as she subsequently writes this two-volume book about her experiences. So initially, it was just going to be a short book about the Moroccan episode in her life, which was all I knew. But I happened to be in California as a guest of UCLA, and I was about to begin my lecture about Elizabeth Marsh and Morocco. And one of the faculty came up to me just before my lecture and said, "Oh, yes, Elizabeth Marsh. We have her journal about explorations in India in our rare books library. a rather off-putting thing to be told, I must say, immediately before a lecture. But this was really the gateway to my realization that this was much more than just a regional story. This was a global story.
Well, tell us a little bit about the detective work you did for this book.
Well, I find it slightly appropriate, really, that a book about world history is indebted in so many ways to modern aspects of globalization. I would have found it very difficult to write this book without the web, because I just had to go on a search for, I mean, she's not a grand woman, she's not a rich woman, she is in many ways a very marginal woman. So there aren't great archives devoted to her. And I had to seek snatches of information about her across the world. And without the web, without wonderful genealogical websites that so many people now put on the web, without libraries all over the world now making their archive listings available on the web, I think it would have been impossible to track down such a relentlessly itinerant individual as this woman.
Hmm. The value of combining biography with history is really wonderful. I think it gives us a richer understanding of a moment in history. Is this the first time that you've done this, or did you do it in your earlier books?
I've always been interested in the intersection of life stories with more abstract analysis of the past, if you like. I believe that biography, apart from being, of course, innately interesting, but biography is very good for the historian because it acts as a check on undue generalization. It makes us test our hypotheses. And I don't think historians should ever forget that, you know, our subject is nothing less than the lives of all the men and women in the past who have lived and died. And just occasionally focusing in on particular individuals and looking at them in as much depth as you can is a reminder of this human component of the past. It makes you stop. It makes you think so that you don't just talk about sweeps of economic power or the rise and fall of empires. You start thinking about the human repercussions. Mm. And I don't think historians should ever lose sight of that.
Yeah, it puts us on the land and in the living spaces of those who went before us.
Indeed.
Elizabeth Marsh, she was conceived in Jamaica, born in England. She may have been a mixed racial parentage. Her father, Milburn Marsh, was in the Navy. What was Jamaica like when he first came ashore in Port Royal? And maybe you would tell us a little bit about Milburn Marsh's background.
Milburn Marsh is a ship's carpenter. He comes from, I suppose one would say, in 18th century terminology, a working class background. But as ship's carpenters have to be, he's a literate man. He's very highly skilled. To be a ship's carpenter at a time when wooden sailing ships are the only means of transport for, you know, for any long journey on water is a considerable craft. And so although he's working class, he has a skill to barter, which he moves around the world with. Jamaica, when he arrived there in 1734, was Britain's most important plantation economy, a terrible place in many ways, full of slaves, very high death rates, not just for the slaves themselves, but also for whites, because disease levels are very, very high. It's a place that is at once very profitable for the plantation owners, for the investments, a place of terrible suffering, But it's also a kind of frontier place where people can move about and change their lives in different ways. And it seems to me very appropriate in a way that this is the place where Marsh is conceived, given that Marsh is going to change so much and reinvent herself so much at different stages of her life.
Yeah, and one wonders if Elizabeth Evans, her mother, if indeed Evans was her name, was also a woman who, she was the perfect mother for Elizabeth Marsh, if you know what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying it very well. That Elizabeth Evans, her life was in kind of a flux, and this gets to this question of what her racial background was.
Yes, she's a great blank in the archives, and insofar as there is any archival information on this woman, it points in different directions. And there's a further complexity in that at one level, Jamaica in 1734, 1735 is a place of bitter racial divides. But the reality of life in Jamaica is that miscegenation is widespread. A lot of people are mixed race. A lot of people are shifting around on the racial and power spectrum, so much so that the rulers of Jamaica actually say in 1735, they decide very arbitrarily that you can move from being black to white in three generations. Now, at one level, that's grotesque. At another level, it gives you some indication, the fact that they had to make that pronouncement, of how multiple and complex racial alignments were. So it's difficult to know, even if Elizabeth's mother was what we would now call mixed race, how exactly she would have perceived herself. Until we discover a new cache of Marsh letters, all I can do is situate question marks in the reader's mind.
Mm. Now, how was it that the couple went to England, where Elizabeth Marsh was born?
It was partly a response to the level of violence in Jamaica in 1735. There were Maroon risings that year. The Maroons, the name given to slaves who ran away and became guerrilla fighters. Levels of tension, of military threat in 1735 were very great. And I think that's one reason why Milburn Marsh was determined to take his new wife, once she became pregnant, back to England. But also we know that this woman Milburn Marsh married, whatever her ethnic mix, she had had a child before who had died in infancy, which was the fate of most children, black or white, born in Jamaica at this time. And I suspect one of the personal reasons why they decided to go back to England was that it was bound to be, so they hoped, a much healthier place for the new Elizabeth Marsh, in other words, our Elizabeth Marsh's mother, to give birth, so that there wouldn't be a risk that she would lose yet another child to divorce, to disease, as she lost her first child.
Hmm. Elizabeth Marsh, the daughter of Elizabeth and Milburn, came of age in England. What was her childhood and the childhood of her brothers and sisters like in Portsmouth? What was life like there?
She has no sisters, but she does have younger brothers eventually. One of the things that's absolutely crucial to Elizabeth Marsh's progress is that virtually all her life, she lives either in seaports or by great rivers. So she spends almost all her life within sight of the water. And this, I think, is very important. People who've researched on maritime communities in the 18th century, both in Britain and in the American colonies, find that most of the people who go to sea are those who are born near it, because they just take the sea for granted. They're not afraid of it. It's just part of their lives. And I think this is something that, okay, Elizabeth Marsh is obviously female, but she takes the sea for granted, movement by sea for granted. And in addition, one of the reasons why she does this is that, like many women and children attached to the Royal Navy, we know that she accompanied her menfolk on sea journeys when Milbourne Marsh was at sea pursuing his craft of being a shipwright. At times he seems to have taken his wife and his children with him. And it's only recently that historians have begun to realize that these great navy warships of the 18th century very often had women and children aboard. So Elizabeth Marsh would have been traveling really from the time she toddled.
Hmm. Then in 1755, the family left for the Mediterranean and Menorca. And I believe you closed this chapter by saying Elizabeth Marsh was on her way. What happens next?
Oh, what doesn't happen?
Yeah.
Well, there's a big earthquake in Portugal in 1755. She feels the aftershocks of that in Menorca, but this is only the beginning of much more serious aftershocks. In 1756, you get the outbreak of what British historians call the Seven Years' War, American historians call the French and Indian War. It is probably the closest to a global war that there has ever been up to this point, with repercussions in the Americas, in Asia, in Africa, as well as in Europe. And Elizabeth gets caught out in one of its early European manifestations. The French invade Menorca. She and her family are forced to flee to Gibraltar, whereupon Elizabeth, with the kind of determination to rush upon peril that's going to characterize her life, decides in 1756 that she's not going to stay in Gibraltar, that she's going to take a ride on a merchant ship to Lisbon. On that voyage from Gibraltar to Lisbon, the ship is captured by Moroccan corsairs. Elizabeth is taken with the other captives to Rabat on Morocco's Atlantic coast, and then made to ride hundreds of miles across desert to Marrakesh, where she has two astonishing discussions, encounters with the acting sultan, this really remarkable ruler, Sidi Mohammed.
Yeah, tell us about him.
He is clearly a really extraordinary ruler who deserves to be much better known than he is. Later on in his reign, for example, he's going to become the first Muslim ruler to acknowledge American independence. As this suggests, he's a man of very broad horizons. He's very interested in making Morocco a richer state. He's interested in forging links with not just other Muslim powers, but with as many Western powers as he can as well. And one of the reasons he orders his corsairs to take this merchant ship on which Elizabeth is traveling captive is that he wants to coerce the British into signing a new trade treaty with him. So he's both an aggressor, but at a certain level, he also wants much closer contacts between cultures. At this stage, he's in his mid-30s. He's very tall by contemporary standards. He's a man of considerable culture and intellectual interests. He runs his own slave system. We tend to forget that Morocco, like other North African powers, not only has black slaves, but it does have European and indeed some American slaves taken at sea. And the first thing that Elizabeth has to worry about is that she may become a slave, which for a woman has obvious sexual implications.
How does she escape the harem?
Well, she describes this in her rather remarkable two-volume book, The Female Captive, which comes out in 1767. I think one of the things that she's got, well, she has two things going for her. First, unfortunately, Sidi Muhammad is a deeply religious man. And Elizabeth is able, or partially able perhaps, to convince him that she's not a single woman, that she is married. She claims to be married to one of her fellow captives, James Crisp. And the prospect of coercing a married woman into his seraglio, that would have given Sidi Muhammad pause. I think also he would have considered that if this did become something of a scandal, given that he does want a trade treaty with Britain, given that Britain has a most powerful navy, this might not be a good thing to do. He certainly tries his luck. He has two long interviews with Elizabeth, talking to her obviously through an interpreter. He offers her gifts from all over the world. And she's clearly at a certain level deeply taken by this man's considerable charisma and culture. Sidi Muhammad runs a very cosmopolitan court. One of the things that Elizabeth notes, for example, is that the horticulturalists working in Sidi Muhammad's palace gardens are Danish. So this is a man who is borrowing from different cultures. And it's quite clear from her retrospective account of this that Marsh is at a certain level bedazzled by this rather splendid, though autocratic, individual.
It seems also, though, that she is a woman of some poise.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, I mean, one of the most tantalizing things I had to cope with when writing about Elizabeth is that we have none of her letters. We have various travel journals by her. We have writings of members of her family. But we don't have letters of hers, or at least they haven't been discovered yet. If any of your listeners have them in the attic, I would be delighted to know. It's challenging to try and come to grips with this woman's temperament. But it's clear that she does make a powerful impact on people. And I suspect, again, one of the reasons of this is that she's connected to seafaring folk. We know from a lot of work that's been done that women, the women folk of sailors, tend to have a strong element of independence in their makeup. They have to, because their menfolk are often away. So you find navy wives, seafarers' wives, they are far more autonomous, often far more assertive than some of their sisters whose menfolk work on land, because they have to be.
Yeah. One of the things that you say about her is that she was addicted to writing. So what we have how much do we have of those books and journals and whatnot?
We have this really rather remarkable two-volume book, which she publishes in London about her Moroccan experiences in 1767. She publishes it then because she's encountered yet another crisis in her life. Her husband has gone bankrupt. He's gone off to India, leaving her alone in Britain with two young children. And she really has to try and make some money for herself. And so this is one of the reasons, I think, why she publishes her story, but though she has other reasons. And we have that book. We have some rough drafts of that book. And then we have this really rather remarkable journal that she compiles in yet a further crisis of her life when they are now in northern India, settled in Dhaka. Only Elizabeth Marsh doesn't settle. At the end of 1774, she takes a ship to Madras, and then she goes on this extraordinary 18-month journey, traveling purely with male companions to explore the eastern and southern regions of the Indian subcontinent, visiting temples and mosques and markets and various palaces and so forth. And she composes as she goes this travel journal of her Indian progress that is at once naive, inevitably ignorant in many ways because she's had no formal education, but is full of remarkable insights into the sights she sees and the various peoples that she encounters on the way.
What were her attitudes towards the people she came across in India?
It's I think, mixed, and I think it changes over time. One of the things I was very determined when I wrote about this woman was neither to pretend to know what I didn't know. So I don't make things up. I mean, there are gaps, and I try to indicate where there are. But I also was determined not to romanticize her. There's no doubt that in many ways, when you read her accounts of meeting indigenous people in India or the Indian subcontinent between 1774 and 1776, she's often dismissive. She would have had the customary racial prejudices in part of her time. But she does become more mellow and more flexible as she goes along. I mean, by the end of her journey, she's wearing Indian garments herself. And also, I think her acquaintance with people would have been very mixed from the beginning. And again, this is partly due to her naval heritage. We know that the Royal Navy employed many black and Asian sailors, both free blacks and slave sailors. So Elizabeth Marsh would have been used from very early on to seeing people from different racial and religious backgrounds. And although she is prejudiced, she's also increasingly relaxed, I think, on this Indian journey. I'm struck, for example, when the man that she's traveling with most of the time, who she calls her cousin, his name is George Smith. He's a captain. He may have been her lover also, we don't know. When he has to leave her two-thirds of the way through her journey, she's entirely alone on this rather perilous journey going along the eastern Indian coast, just with Indian servants, Indian helpers. she is the only woman who can pass for white in this company. And she seems quite relaxed about it, very not worried, not anxious, trusting. So I think her attitudes to other peoples are at one level firmly 18th century, firmly in accordance with some of the prevailing prejudices of her time, but they are also flexible and they do change over time.
Hmm. Did she write about her emotional life?
She wrote about her emotional life in some respects, but I think under many layers of disguise. It is important to remember this is a woman without formal education. She would have learnt to write on board ship. Again, she owes so many things to the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy employed school teachers on ships who taught the children on these ships and some of the adults too how to read and write. So she is literate. We know she likes novels. But she often borrows from the novels of her time, I think, to express her emotions rather than admit to them directly. I said that when she published her Tales of Morocco in 1767, this was partly because her husband was bankrupt and had left her, having gone to India, and that's true. But I think another reason was that at that point she feels deeply ashamed twice over. She feels that her reputation has first suffered by what's happened in Morocco. She's had to marry this man, James Crisp, a fellow captive, because the man who she was engaged to when she was captured in Morocco basically dumps her. So she feels that her reputation has been damaged in Morocco. Now it's been damaged again by her husband becoming bankrupt. And I think one of the ways you can read her book about Morocco, it's not just a description of what happened to her in North Africa. It's also a way in which she tries to assert herself. She tries to explain that she is a woman of some resolution, that she did defend her virtue in Morocco, that this is something she cared about, that she is a woman of substance. So there is emotion there. I think, for example, one can trace the deteriorating relationship she has with her husband in her writings, but it's not necessarily direct. She is aware of the constraints on what she can say according to the conventions of her time.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Linda Colley. She is the author, most recently, of The Ordeal of Elizabeth Marsh, A Woman in World History. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon if you have a question, a comment. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thinking now of this period of world history, in the mid-1770s, she is in India. Her husband is in India. And the American Revolution breaks out. How did the revolution affect Elizabeth Marsh and her situation and her family?
It changed everything because the American Revolutionary War is not just about the colonies winning their independence. This approaches a global war. It provokes because of the number of powers that become involved in it. The American Revolutionary War provokes fighting in the Caribbean, in Asia, in Europe itself. And it's a terrible conflict in many ways for Elizabeth's family, because so many of them are caught up with the Navy, with the British state, with the East India Company. And she loses various members of her family in these wars. But she also is in a perilous situation because the scale of the war destroys a lot of the business of her husband, this very enterprising but deeply unfortunate man, James Crisp, who'd, having been bankrupted in 1767, having reconstructed his fortunes in northern India, dealing in textiles, now finds the market for his textiles damaged by the outbreak of war in so many parts of the world, and basically loses money again. So one of the things Elizabeth has to do during this global war, which is affecting so many more people and so many other parts of the world, she has to try and save herself. Her husband, it's quite clear, is going downhill again. She has to raise money for herself. She has to find a job for her son, her younger son, Burrish Crisp. And she also has to try and raise money for a dowry for her daughter, who otherwise will be left portionless and therefore not be in a position to find a suitable husband. So the story of the American War and Elizabeth Marsh is really at two levels. There's the formal events of the war, which impact on her career, but also she's fighting her own war. She's fighting her own war to survive herself, to raise money, given that her husband is now going terminally downhill, and to salvage the futures of her children,
yeah.
All of which she succeeds in doing.
Yes. Elizabeth Maria eventually does marry and marries well.
She does,
yeah.
Yes. She marries an Irishman who's working in India, an Irish Catholic who ultimately becomes a baronet, a government official, an imperial official, and who ultimately has rather grand houses in England, in Ireland, and in London. So, yes, in the end, her daughter, who by all accounts is a very beautiful girl, very talented, very musical, does come through, though poor Elizabeth Marsh herself never lives to see this triumph of her daughter.
Yeah. And her son, Burrish Crisp, what happened to him?
He gets reasonably well established too, though I think that he is also badly damaged by some of the tumultuous events that have engulfed his parents again and again and again. And also by Elizabeth Marsh is a remarkable woman. She's also quite a ruthless woman. She has to be to survive. And one of the aspects, if you like, of her ruthlessness is that no sooner has she got to India in the early 1770s, settled there briefly with her husband, and together they decide that their son, Burrish, who's then only about 11 years old, should be sent off to Persia, which is now Iran, to learn the languages there, because they decide that if he's to make his fortune in the Indian subcontinent as a trader, as an official, he needs a spectrum of indigenous languages. So this little 11-year-old boy who's only just arrived in India from Britain is bundled off to Persia only with a Persian merchant and spends a year there learning Farsi. Burrish Crisp survives this experience. He does become linguistically fluent in many Asian languages. He's able to have an administrative career, a scholarly career as a translator. But he never establishes a proper relationship. He's never particularly at ease with himself. One wonders, one's bound to wonder now whether he was abused sexually on some of the voyages and travels he had to make by himself as a little boy. So this is just one of the members of Elizabeth Marsh's extended family who get caught up in these great movements between continents, and who is undoubtedly damaged in the process, even though he gets his career in the end.
Mm. And what became of the grandchildren of Elizabeth Marsh?
There are two grandchildren who I focus on. They're very different. Burrish has a son by an Indian woman whose name we don't know. That son becomes, who's half Indian, becomes himself a linguist, an army officer working for the British East India Company. He also becomes a scientist. And in his 20s, he does some really rather remarkable scientific experiments in Sumatra. So he continues traveling. The other grandchild, Elizabeth Maria and her Irish husband's son, has a much more glittering career. He is brought up as a European, as a member of the British elite, and actually in the end becomes quite a close friend of a future British Prime Minister, and goes to Cambridge University. So the grandchildren diverge very sharply, indicating, of course, how many different worlds this woman and her family inhabit.
Yeah. In the end, one of the things you say about Elizabeth Marsh is she was a woman who knew discovery and exhilaration. I want to wrap up here, maybe you would offer us a way of looking at her life in total.
It's clearly a remarkable life, but I think it would be wrong just to see this woman as a picaresque heroine, a kind of real-life Moll Flanders. I think you can only make sense of Elizabeth Marsh by realizing the time in which she lived was a time in which transcontinental connections were becoming more common, more intense, for all sorts of reasons, for reasons of war, for reasons of empire, for reasons of the slave trade and other kinds of commerce, for reasons of the passage of ideas. So although this is manifestly not a typical woman, Elizabeth Marsh is in some ways, I think, rather more representative than she seems. The life that she lived would not have been possible in earlier periods. She's an extraordinary woman, but she is also a product of the distinctive times in which she has to spend her life.
There we'll leave it. Linda Colley, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Pleasure.
Linda Colley is the author of The Ordeal of Elizabeth Marsh, A Woman in World History. The book is published by Pantheon. The New York Times named it one of the 10 best books of the year, one of the top 5 nonfiction books of 2007. And our thanks this afternoon to Professor Colley, who joined us this afternoon from Princeton, where Liz Patton was the technical director for our connection this afternoon.